The Tom Woods Show, episode 1589.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I have the best, nicest, smartest, brightest group of like-minded, friendly folks you can possibly imagine, where we learn from each other, we get outraged with each other, we rejoice with each other. It's a wonderful community of folks, and you, as a loyal listener of The Tom Woods Show, belong inside it. It's called The Tom Woods Show Elite, and you can get in there via supportinglisteners.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I don't know what to tell you about today's episode. I really don't, because Dominic Frisby is a guy that most Americans don't know, but he's amazing. He's a humorist. He's an economic commentator. He's an entertainer of all kinds. What I'm going to do is just have him walk us through who Dominic Frisby is, but he's the kind of guy I'm really glad that the Tom Woods Show has given me an opportunity to get to know. He's a funny guy, and you won't agree with him on everything, but remember my episode on how to be a human being? It's not necessary that we agree with somebody on everything. It's just necessary that we try to be human beings together, right? And learn from each other what we can. And the world would be a much poorer place without this delightful human being in it. So Dominic Frisby, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be talking to you again.
The bio on your website is really ridiculous. and I don't blame you. I mean, you have to record all the things you've done and are doing. But number one, you make me feel like a lazy bum. Number two, the diversity of things you've done is very impressive. And number three, it makes it very challenging for an interviewer to know where to begin. So maybe you could, we'll get into the libertarian stuff a little while, but just, you know, we did have you on to talk about your book, Daylight Robbery, on taxation. And I got tremendous feedback, and people in the U.S. were saying, who is this guy? We want to hear from him more. So I would like to introduce you a bit more to my largely American audience. Maybe you can be a bit of a tour guide at the beginning, and then I want to ask you some questions.
Well, okay. I'm 50 years old, Tom, so I've been working for about 30 of those 50 years. And, I didn't plan any of this, but life just happens and you stumble from one thing to the other. But it is, I suppose you'd call my background eclectic or something like that. And because I do so many different things, it's almost a problem because people like to know that you're the guy that does this. You know, you're the guy that's the actor in Game of Thrones, or you're the guy that's, the comedian, or you're the guy that writes the financial stuff. They like to know that you're one particular thing so that they can put you in a little compartment in their mind. And because I've done so many different things, it's almost been my enemy. But I did Italian and drama at university way back when. And then I went to drama school to train as an actor. But I was always the best in drama school at radio. And straight away when I left drama school, I got a lot of work doing voiceovers. And voiceover work, as I'm sure you know, is pretty well paid and you're well treated. And when you're a young guy, 21, 22 years old, and you're going to auditions as an actor and you're treated like dirt, and then suddenly you turn to voiceover and comparatively speaking, you're mini royalty and you're well paid and you're well looked after. You know, it's pretty obvious which route I chose. And I started earning a decent living doing voiceovers in my 20s. But when you do voiceovers, it's like an hour here, a couple of hours there. You get quite a lot of free time. And I wrote this song called The Upper Class Rap, which was a posh guy, an English upper class guy who was attempting to become a rapper. And this was would have been about 96, something like that. And I tried to get it released as a Christmas novelty single. In those days, you know, you could do novelty singles, did quite well. This was before the internet. And a friend who I'd been at university with was a music agent. And he represented bands like the Scissor Sisters. I don't know if you know the Scissor Sisters. He was quite successful. And I said, look, I've got this song. And he said, go and perform it at my brother's club. And his brother ran a comedy club in Southeast London. which was the most sort of notoriously rough comedy club in London at the time. And they used to have this thing on Sunday evenings called the open spot nights, where they'd have a couple of paid acts, then they'd have all the open spots. And the audience just used to throw things at the open spots and boo them off and all the rest of it. And then they'd have a closing act. But if you did well as an open spot, you were given what was called a half spot. You were given a paid booking the following week. So I borrowed my flatmate at the time's suit and I dressed, and he was an estate agent, a real estate agent. So he had this sort of double-breasted pinstripe suit that made him look very important. And I wore that on the stage. And it was just after the general election in 1997 when Tony Blair had got elected. And it was absolute mayhem in the room. The previous act had been booed off. People were throwing things at the stage. It was chaos. And I went on. I said, "Oh, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Dominic and I'm the rapper." And everyone just, it was just mayhem in there. I'll never forget the noise, just throwing stuff, calling for the compere. And in those days, it was a cassette. And the sound man put on the cassette, which was had my backing track on it. And I did the song. And fortunately, it made everyone laugh. And, you know, the next minute I know people coming up to me in the bar afterwards and offering me record contracts.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it was just some chancery. It wasn't a genuine thing. But the club then honoured their promise and gave me a booking the following week. And I did that, and that went very well. And then they gave me another booking. And then they gave me my first paid 20, which was a full booking. And that was on the day that Lady Diana died, of all things. And that was my first 20. And so suddenly I had all these dates in the diary, and I was being paid money, and I was a stand-up comedian. And so I literally fell into stand-up comedy from voiceovers. And that took up the next, you know, whatever years of my life. And then in the late, this would have been in the late noughties now, just 2006, something like that. I'd made a bit of money and I wanted to invest it. And I started listening to all these people on the internet. I started talking to all these fund managers and they all wanted to take their 2-3%. I didn't entirely trust them. And I started reading the internet and I started reading about gold. And I was like, oh my goodness me. And suddenly when you start reading about gold and gold's history as money and the relationship between money and freedom and how governments abuse fiat money and all the, suddenly so much of how the world works becomes clear. And so I started investing in gold with a certain amount of success because, you know, it was in a big bull market at the time. And that's when I suddenly realized I'm a libertarian. I had no idea I was a libertarian, but suddenly, because I was always confused by politics. People would sort of shout at you if you didn't agree with left-wing stuff at university. And I sort of went along generally with the left-wing thing, but was never that interested in it. And then suddenly, as a result of gold and its history as money, as I say, I realized I was a libertarian. And there were all these really interesting people on the internet talking, James Turk and Jim Rogers and various others. James Dines was a guy. And I thought, I really want to talk to these people. How do I get to talk to these people? So I used my audio background again and I started a podcast. And of course, all these people, everyone's promoting their own brand and they were all happy to come on the podcast and talk to me. And as I'm sure you know this, Tom, from your own experience, the best way to get to know somebody quickly is to interview them because yeah. It's like a distilled conversation. You get to know somebody really quickly. And so I started interviewing James Turk and Jim Rogers and various others. And suddenly I was sort of mates with all these guys. And one lady I interviewed was a woman called Merin Somerset Webb, who runs a magazine. She was the editor of a magazine in the UK called Money Week. Incredibly bright woman. And the thing about Money Week, it's the best-selling UK weekly financial publication, is she said, "Oh, we need people like you to come and write for us because most people who write about finance are boring. Will you come and write for us?"
This is ridiculous. This story is ridiculous.
Yeah. And so, but then suddenly I'm a financial writer. And so I'm a comedian and I must be the world's only comedian and financial writer who does voiceovers. But, you know, one thing just fell into another. And then Bitcoin came along. So I thought, oh, I'll write a book about that. And then this guy came to me, said, I've written this film called Four Horsemen. And I think it's really good, but it's just a mess. I need someone to rewrite it. So I went and wrote this film called Four Horsemen, which is a huge kind of internet sensation. And it got like 10 million views on the internet, all about the financial crisis. Nobody worked on that film, which, by the way, was calling for economic reform, got paid. But anyway, that's by the by. But so you know what life is like, Tom. Everyone talks about government planning, but stuff just happens and you just got to kind of roll with it.
That is a heck of a story. All right. So now we have a million things we want to talk about. But one of them actually is more recent even than anything we've gotten to in the story. And that is your position on Brexit.
Oh, yeah.
Which I share, but I do want to ask you a little something about it. Now, by the way, one thing I want to tell you about this podcast is I make sure that the language is, let's say, PG by American standards, so okay. that when parents are driving in the car, they don't have to explain new vocabulary to their children. That's the key thing for me. So we'll just say you have a video that I just watched on Brexit called 70 million. Is it 70 million?
17.
That's what I meant to say. Sorry, I beg your pardon. Of course, I meant to say, I do know the numbers involved. 17 million, let's say, F-offs, all right?
Yeah.
And it is so brilliantly done because the key theme you're hammering away at is the people who were insisting on remaining in the EU were doing two things. Number one, insisting that they're better than you.
Yeah.
That they are better than you. They know better than you. You're a stupid backward hick, which is not the way you persuade somebody. It just isn't. And secondly, the wild predictions they made of what would happen if the UK went its own way is astonishing. So can you elaborate now in non-song form about those two points?
Sure, with pleasure. And again, that song was another happy accident in that I've always liked songs and song lyrics. And I wanted to find a way of, like, you know, rather than having to pay an accompanist to come on stage with me and play while I do these songs, I started learning the ukulele because I'd understood that ukulele was, it was quite easy to get to a reasonable level quite quickly on the ukulele. And I was having this ukulele lesson. And over the course of like a few months, my ukulele, if you can imagine your sort of archetypal Englishman in a tweed jacket with a thin pencil moustache, very polite and respectful and all those things. And he was just the most polite man. And his name was Martin. And I started having these ukulele lessons. And over the course of time, I just would make the odd kind of political comment or something. And I realized that he's the most militant libertarian that you'll ever meet in your life. I mean, and, you know, really passionate about it, but he just keeps his politics to himself. But gradually, I just sort of inched it out of him that I had this militant libertarian ukulele teacher. And I said, look, I've got this idea for this song, Martin, where every time the British were told something about what was going to happen if we voted to leave the European Union, every time the English, they saw it for the BS that it was, and they just said, F off. And so we started writing this lesson, and the song almost wrote itself because the things that we'd been told were just so ridiculous. And the people who told them were all, you know, whether it's President Obama or David Cameron or George Osborne or, you know, all the celebrities in the UK. It just wrote itself. And I remember doing it and I went and did it. We wrote it on the Monday. I went and did it in a comedy club on the Tuesday. And somebody came up to me and said, that's really good. And then I phoned up Martin. I said, I think we're onto something here, Martin. And Martin said, go and record it in my friend's front room. So we went to the studio that it was his friend's front room. And we recorded the song on the Wednesday. And then my other friend makes videos. And we made the song on the Thursday. And we put it on the internet on the Friday. And it just went totally viral. It really hit a nerve. And it was released last March when we were supposed to leave the European Union, but Parliament had found a way of delaying it and doing all the things it was doing, obfuscating and trying to undermine the democratic vote and so on. And it just went totally viral. And all the MPs who were in Parliament and pro-Brexit were all playing it in the House of Commons. And it's literally this terrible, terrible language, but it's based on an old English folk tune. And it just hit a real nerve. And then suddenly this campaign started to get the song to number one. And it nearly got there. And, you know, it was number one in the Amazon charts and it was number one on iTunes. And the only reason it didn't get to number one properly is the way that the charts are calculated with streaming and so on. That's our equivalent of your Billboard charts. It's really hard to compete against the record labels. And so suddenly I'd written this accidental, nearly number one song. And like I say, it was all just accident.
I don't know. It's very rare that a guest leaves me totally speechless, but I just love your life. I love your life. What an interesting life it is. All right. I want to follow up on this with a couple things. First is more of a philosophical question. I encountered on Twitter, see, right away, you know, this story is going downhill, somebody who describes himself as an anarchist who favored Remain. And I thought, how could you be an anarchist and say, I want the biggest governmental structure I can find, and I'm going to support that. Like, I'm not happy enough with my own government. I need another big one over on top of that, and I'll call myself an anarchist. I thought, this guy is an archist. Clearly, he's not an anarchist. Like, what could he be thinking? And
yeah,
I want to tell you, in all, you know, just to be fair to the guy, what his response was, it was as follows. He said, think about the practical effect of the EU. What is the practical effect? The practical effect is it brings about the freedom of movement, the easy, convenient freedom of movement of people and goods over a huge expanse of territory. And that is the sort of thing that an anarchist wants to see. And so if you have Brexit, that's going to break down. Now, there are two possible responses to this, it seems to me. Number one is to debate whether that breaks down. But number two, what would be the source of restrictions on freedom of movement or of people or goods, if not government? So why wouldn't the anarchist just be upset at the remaining states, you know, at the states themselves? They're the ones creating these obstacles. Now, one way to deal with the obstacles is the EU, and the other way is to be really, really an anarchist, really opposed to these states, and tell them to knock it off. So how do you respond to something like that?
Well, firstly, you know, an anarchist and a libertarian is sort of, I suppose you'd call a libertarian a minarchist. But, you know,
some of us do think of ourselves as libertarian anarchists.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. You know, some days I'm a minarchist, some days I'm a classical liberal, some days I'm a libertarian, some days I'm an anarchist. It's sort of, you know, I'm a bit inconsistent in that regard, but I certainly believe that taxes should be, you know, 10% of GDP and not 40 to 50% of GDP, put it that way. Or government should be 10% of GDP, not 40 to 50%. But anyway, leaving that aside for the moment, you know, the Leave, for me, has to be the libertarian stroke anarchist position, because by definition, you are removing a layer of government. Now, it might be that in leaving, you end up replacing that layer of government with even more government, in which case, you know, your friend the anarchist's argument might hold some water. But, you know, most libertarians were in favor of leaving the EU. They wanted more localization and less centralization of power. Now, onto the free movement thing. Now, I think if you're a true anarchist or a libertarian, you don't care about free movement. You know, you believe in no passports, no national borders and all that kind of thing, which is something for which I have a lot of sympathy. But if you have an expansive welfare state with the state providing education and streets and healthcare and all these things that the state does in Europe and to a slightly lesser extent in America, then you can't have open borders. You know, the two are mutually incompatible, because otherwise you get into a huge you can't have open borders and have existing taxpayers paying for all these things. The system of government and infrastructure just can't cope with it. So I really do think when you get into the immigration argument, it's a straight argument. If you want open borders, then you can't have a benevolent and expansive welfare state. If you want closed borders, then you can. So, you know, as a libertarian, I would argue for no borders and no welfare state. But I have a lot of sympathy for people who, you know, and the other thing with immigration is in many cases, I just think mass immigration, mass movement of people is inevitable. But whether it's people displaced by war, by famine, by economic hardship, by lack of water, all the various things that are going on in various countries around the world. There are more and more people in the world, and more of them are on the move than ever before. So it's inevitable that there's going to be mass movement of people. But I also have a lot of sympathy for the conservative argument that national culture, you know, if you take a look at London, for example, you know, the capital of England, white people are now the minority in London. Then they're no longer the majority. And you know, if you think of the archetypical Londoner as a Cockney, which is the white bloke, call blimey governor, all white son, talks like that, would be born. And the idea of a Cockney is that they're born within the sound of Bow Bells. Now, that's Bow Cathedral in the East End of London. And that's normally about, the sound of Bow Bells is about a mile around Bow. And that is where the Cockney, the archetypal Londoner, comes from. Now, if you go to Bow now, it's a predominantly Asian area, particularly Muslim. And so now, the idea that a Muslim is the typical Cockney is, it just isn't. Now, it sounds like I'm criticizing Muslim people here, and I'm not for a second. The point I'm making is that the Cockney, which is the archetypical Londoner, it just no longer exists in the way that he used to. So that particular aspect, rightly or wrongly, has disappeared from, or is disappearing from, London tradition. They've had our sort of own version of white flight, and they've all moved to Kent and Essex and so on. Now, I'm not saying that that's a good or a bad thing. I'm just saying that is what has happened. And a lot of, you know, conservative English people feel threatened. They feel that their traditions, their cultures, their ways of life are being undermined by this large immigration. So, you know, my stance on that is, if somebody wants to go from A to B, let them. But it's sort of almost been sponsored by government planning, this mass immigration. And I'd much rather it happened organically, put it that way, rather than as a result of government economic intervention. You know, there's this whole thing, we've got to pay for the NHS. You know, one consequence of immigration is it really has pushed down wages. And again, as somebody, as a consumer, I like that because it means I get cheaper products. But I also have, and often, you know, the immigrant workers are often very good. The standard of their work is often very high. But on the other hand, it has meant that the working class British people have had this huge downward pressure on their wages. And so, you know, and employers are obviously going to employ the guy who does the best job for the least possible price. And that's put downward pressure on working class wages and has contributed to this huge wealth gap that we have, not just in the UK, but across the West. And so, again, I understand working class resentment to immigration because of this, you know, it's tangible that it's affected their wages. So it's really not a simple argument at all. And you can't be pro-immigration or anti-immigration. But I come back to my initial point. If you want an expansive state, then you cannot have open borders. And that is what Europe is struggling to come to terms with at the moment.
Well, you know, at the risk of turning the whole episode into this topic, which I prefer not to do, I'll just point out, I personally think one of the weaker arguments is this argument about wages, because the same sorts of effects seem to occur sometimes with the introduction of a new technology that is very, very beneficial to society at large, and that particular concentrated groups might want to stop that for their own individual perceived benefit. But if we all stopped all these things, we would all be poorer. And in the long run, we actually do better off with the introduction of the technology.
But, Tom, I completely agree with you. I'm merely articulating the dissatisfaction.
Oh, no, I totally understand that.
I
do understand that. And I think the sorts of things you're saying are the sorts of things that, let's say, the I'd like to call them the sophisticated libertarians. They're not really. They think they are. They want to be. They desperately want to be thought of as sophisticated. These are the sorts of things they would turn their noses up at. Oh, what a bunch of collectivists that they care about their culture. But I have a feeling if it were, let's say, indigenous peoples who were being put upon by outside invaders, let's say, and I know the word invaders is loaded, but if it were indigenous people and there were people who wanted to come live with them, well, this would be viewed as totally different. Well, no, leave them alone. Well, hold on a minute. I thought it was an unambiguously good thing for this to happen. Or as somebody gave the example recently on the program, if the Sioux Indians suddenly had, let's say, 1,000 people from Switzerland show up and say, hey, everybody, we're going to be Sioux Indians like you. I mean, only adult would think that made any sense. Like, surely these are a people and they have some kind of common history, and it's not collectivist or stupid or backward or ignorant for them to think maybe it's something worth preserving. You know, I mean, it's the same way that, I mean, all non-whites feel this way. The Japanese feel this way. I don't think it's fair to say every Japanese person is evil and racist because they have a fairly small amount of immigration. I mean, you would have to be extremely closed-minded and backward yourself to speak that way about the people of the world, it seems to me.
Yeah, I have to say, on Japan, I was there last year for the first time in my life, and it is a great country. It is just great. And I really like, it's got this weird mix of, at times you think you're 30, 40, 50 years in the future, and then times you think you're like 200 years in the past. And, you know, their immigration policy, I mean, again, you can say it's worked for them because it's conserved a lot of their traditions. And you can say, oh, look at Japan. It's not diverse. There's no diversity in Japan. I mean, I'm kind of sick of the diversity argument anyway, but you know, you can make both criticisms about it, but they've made that choice. And by the way, when I said about London, Beau being largely Muslim, that's inaccurate. It's I would say it's African and Asian rather than, you know, Caucasian. But so, I mean, it's a two-edged sword, but for sure, Europe has never seen, and particularly Britain, has never seen immigration on the scale that we've seen it in the last 25 years. And I'm not saying I agree with it, but I'm saying I can understand why a lot of local people feel threatened by it and don't like it and want something done about it. And the problem is no leader worth his salt will do anything about it, because the other side of the argument just immediately smear them as racist. And
oh, yeah,
you cannot
even have a conversation. Yeah,
so that's I mean, I'm amazed we've even got as far as we have in this conversation.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's like a reign of terror. You're asking totally reasonable questions. You're making reasonable points. The other side, I think, on this often speaks in platitudes. Now, there are some smart people who've done some interesting research on immigration, and I respect those people. And sometimes they make me consider new arguments, and that's all to the good. But that's very rare, because we all know that in our society, the easiest way to win is just to hurl a career-destroying smear at somebody. Now, the beautiful thing about what you and I do is we've built our own platforms. They can say anything they want to about us. I still have my own platform, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, haha, sucker, you know. Sucks to be you.
Until YouTube,
right?
Or someone takes it away from you. But
yeah,
yeah,
but that's
why
I don't depend on YouTube in any way. You know, they take YouTube away from me, does not matter. I mean, I would be shocked if they thought I was worth taking down. I just don't see that happening. But I do want to ask you related, because this all came out of our Brexit conversation.
Yeah.
I want to go from that to the idea of doing stand-up comedy that has a political angle to it. Now, I don't know that all your stand-up comedy does, but obviously if you played that song at a comedy club, you're willing to be politically edgy. Now, in the United States, it's very difficult to be political and a comedian these days, unless you're anti-Trump and then everybody laughs. But it's so predictable. And part of what makes comedy is that part of what makes the human being laugh is incongruity. Right. And it's the unexpected. But I already know the comedian doesn't like Trump, so that makes it not as funny. But if you try to be pro-Trump, they basically, you know, murder you and you're never heard from again. But I would think Brexit, it seems to me, was fought out almost as passionately as Trump versus anti-Trump. How do you take that to a comedy club?
Well, Brexit is our Trump, you know, it is our populist revolt. If Trump's your populist revolt, Brexit is ours. And it's quite interesting because when I would go and do financial talks and I'd ask the people how they're going to vote in the Brexit referendum, it would usually be about 70-80% were in favor of Brexit. When I go to comedy clubs, it was the reverse. It was the audiences are 80% remain, probably even more. Depends where you are in the country, of course, but I'm talking about in London. And, you know, among comedy audiences, that sort of, you know, the sort of people who like Bernie Sanders, you know, the sort of people who like him, like Jeremy Corbyn, got that sort of left-wing worldview, think that, you know, some kind of government response is the answer to most things. That kind of worldview dominates most comedy audiences, particularly in London. Left, not even that as left as Bernie Sanders, but just left of centre, from, you know, social democrat, slightly socialist, left-wing worldview. And a lot of people on that side of the, whereas, you know, what tends to happen is if a guy's doing, you know, anti-right-wing stuff in a comedy club, most right-wing audiences will just put a stiff upper lip, smile politely, and the act moves on. Whereas if a right-wing guy does stuff to a left-wing crowd, the left-wing crowd will often be a lot more aggressive with that comedian. So I tended to avoid politics in my act because I just, and particularly because I MC a lot and I'm the host. And I just didn't want to, I don't want to split the room 50-50 or 70-30 or whatever. I don't want to get into political arguments. They're not that funny. I'm just the host, the nice guy. So I just did that. But then I started writing the songs, and the songs are, of course, a lot more political, and it's harder to heckle a song because you're playing music. But I tend to do if I'm just doing a regular comedy club in a regular part of town, Birmingham or London or Oxford, I tend not to be that political. If I'm doing a night where people have come to see me or where it's overtly stated that it is, because there's this new night called Comedy Unleashed, for example, where it's free thinking. It's called the Free Thinking Comedy Club. And the idea is you can go there and have wrong opinions and say them without fear of being lynched or excommunicated or whatever it is. And so it's a great, because I'll be very political in there. And most people in that audience tend to share my sort of libertarian worldview, whether it's a left or a right-leaning libertarian, but they're quite anti-authoritarian. But yeah, so if it's people coming to see me or a particular night, then I'll be political. But if it's just a regular comedy night, then I'll blunt the blade a little bit. And probably as a result, the comedy won't be as good.
Oh, geez, this is, you know, it's so interesting that you've been able to balance all these different careers in just one person, because each one of them is something that generally a person spends a lifetime, you know, honing and getting better at and learning more about. And you seem to be, I mean, it would be unimpressive if you did all these things and you did each of them extremely badly, you know, but you do all these things and you do them all very well. So the fact that you stumbled into stand-up comedy, that's a field that can chew you up and spit you out.
And it's done that to me many times, Tom.
Well, let me ask you one thing before I let you go, just because I'm curious about every comedian whenever I talk to them. I've only a couple of times been in an audience where a comedian has lost the audience. He's bombing. And once you lose them, it's extremely difficult to get them back.
Yeah.
Have you ever been in that position? Not because of politics, but just because your jokes aren't landing for some reason. Have you had that experience? And if so, how do you come back, or do you come back at all?
Tom, I've died more times than I care to remember. And, you know, we used to have a comedian, there's a guy called Steve Bowditch, and he used to say, old school of the circuit, and he used to say, you're not a comedian until you've died. That was one of his sayings he used to say. Every comedian has died. And the bigger the death, the greater the comedian in some cases. I've seen some epic deaths. I remember there was this gig once in Nottingham, and there was a comedian called Johnny Vegas. And you know that scene in the film about Andy Kaufman with Jim Carrey when he starts reading, I think it's Catcher in the Rye, or he starts reading some book. And gradually the audience, one by one, just get up and they all start filing out until there's one person left in the audience. Well, this gig in Nottingham was 3,000-seater and they did exactly that.
Oh, and my.
I mean, not to me, to another comic, but I mean, I've had epic deaths. When my first act was this rap. And, you know, because it was a funny act, I got promoted to doing regular spots very quickly, but I hadn't actually developed any skills as a comedian yet. I just did the act, which was this sort of rap, and it either went well or it went badly. And if it went badly, I didn't have the equipment to get out of jail, so to speak. And for some reason, if I went on first, it would always die. As long as I went on in the middle, it would storm. But if I went on first, it needed like a regular guy doing stand-up first to offset it. And I've died, particularly early in my career, many, many times. And it's like, I draw the comparison with boxing. You know, when you see a boxer and there's the guy who wins the boxing fight and he's the alpha male of the room and he's cheering and everyone's celebrating. But always when that's going on, look at the guy who's just lost. And he is a broken man. He's no longer the alpha male. And when you die, it's, you know, there's always like a little gap around this guy. People keep their distance. And when you die, nobody wants to talk to you because they don't want to get the lurgy, whatever you've got that's made you die and made the room. Nobody wants to talk to you. So there's always, you can see the black cloud of depression above a comedian's head when they've just died. It's almost visible. And there's always a sort of an uncomfortable silence if the act's sitting in the, nobody wants to talk to him because they don't want to catch the illness. They don't want to get the coronavirus.
That is very, very interesting. Well, that's beautiful thing about what I do is it's not live. And if I do a terrible job, I can always chuck it or re-record or whatever. So what you do takes real, real stones, let's say. So where can people find out more about Dominic Frisby?
I've got a Facebook page called The Dominic Frisby. If you want to follow me on Facebook, and I've got a YouTube channel. I've actually got two YouTube channels, one for comic songs and one for more serious stuff. And on Twitter, @Dominic Frisby. And I suppose YouTube or Twitter is the best place. And yeah, I'm posting songs and videos all the time. So, you know, watch them, like them, share them, all those kind of things. And thanks very much, Tom, for having me on the show.
My pleasure. Is it easy for me to find the Upper Class Rap, by the way?
Do you know what? I did it in the 1990s, and I always regard the year 2000 as the beginning of the internet.
Right, where everything you want is going to be there.
Yeah, it just sort of, the internet began in 2000, and I did the act 97, 98. And so there's a couple of references to it here and there, but it's just in that bizarre kind of thing that there's just no record of it on the internet. I've got an audio version of the song, but there's no videos of it. And so
okay.
Anyway, my more recent stuff's better.
All right. Well, I was just wondering, because for thoroughness, I wanted to put it on the show notes page, but I am going to put the Brexit video that I watched.
Yeah. I can send you an MP3 of the Upper Class Rap.
If there's a place I can get it hosted, I'll put it up there.
All righty. Good stuff.
Okay. Thanks again, Dominic. We'll talk to you soon. Looking forward to our lunch in London next week.
Yeah. It's going to be great fun.
Okay, folks, now that is that for today. But tomorrow we got Peter Schiff coming back on, and I am taking suggestions for questions from my supporting listeners. I've already taken them, so if you're in the group, the episode's already been recorded. So when I have Peter Schiff on, I let people who support my show ask the questions. So Peter's come back on. It's a great conversation. We got that. Scott Horton is going to round out this week, and then next week, beginning with episode 1592. Yes, folks, it's Walter Block week on the Tom Woods Show, and that's going to be a ton of fun too. So if you haven't subscribed, please do so, tomwoods.com/apple. And of course, get my latest free ebook, AOC is Wrong. You think, I already know AOC is wrong, but do you have all the facts and figures? Well, doggone it, you will when you get this free book over at AOCisWrong.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.